Welcome to the Open House podcast site, available at openhousecommunity.com.au.
Now we come to the last of our first Open House series for 2012. Over the last few weeks, we've been journeying through the issue of humility and the power of it, the key to love, life and leadership, with the author of Humilitas, the director of the Centre for Public Christianity, a good friend of Open House, John Dixon. John, welcome back for the last time.
Thanks for having
me. I'm sad that this is coming to an end.
The last time forever, is that right?
No. You'll be back, mate.
I better be good. The last time.
One of the points you make in your book is that humility has the power to influence people, which we've kind of touched on, which might sound somewhat counterintuitive. Surely humility is about serving people. How does that kind of thing work and balance?
Yeah, well, influencing people for good. There you go. That's the answer.
Okay. So, next question.
Well, yeah. If you want to influence people for evil, well, then humility's the wrong course. That's kind of perverse. But the reality is, influencing people when you have their best interests at heart is a jolly good thing. So jump on it.
Yeah.
And the great thing is, humility will enhance that influence. So I would just say, if your motives are right, you have good goals for the sake of other people, then humility actually is a very powerful mode in which you can influence others.
Yeah. You mentioned four important areas of leadership: ability, authority, example, and persuasion, under that kind of umbrella of leadership. Mm. I want to unpack briefly, one by one, each of those and discuss why each is important to leadership. And leadership extends right from the top of the corporate tree down to leading a small group of whatever. Mm. A fairly obvious one first, ability. So explain that.
Yeah, most people who end up in leadership were pretty good at something below that leadership level. Yeah. So whether it's someone who was actually a pretty good accountant and showed a flair for motivating other people, will bubble to the surface.
Yes.
So just about every sporting coach, who's a leader of a sporting team, was a pretty good player somewhere along the line. They weren't necessarily the best, but ability is one of the characteristics of a leader, for sure.
Authority, again, that makes sense.
Yeah, but what I'm talking about there is the external authority an organization gives you. The Manchester United give the authority to Sir Alex Ferguson to, buy players, sack players, bench players, do whatever, right? So he actually has authority. And what I'm saying is that every leader does have these kinds of authorities given by the organization to the leader, but beware, because they're not inherent. These are given to you by the organization. They don't belong to you and therefore shouldn't be abused. So a leader who relies on authority in order to get things done is heading for trouble.
Yeah,
we call that a dictator.
Yes, seen that too. Example, that's another area of leadership that you identify. I think that might be a bit of a surprise, because there'd be those in leadership who'd say, well, I'm the one in charge. It's not about me setting an example. People serve me.
Yeah, but when you find a leader who has ability and authority and is a great example, you can see the magic of it.
Yeah.
Because the bottom line is, we will trust and not be disillusioned by the leader who actually lives the kinds of things they talk about. But we will very easily distrust and lose heart when the leader tells you to do one thing but acts in the opposite way. So example is actually a core part of what helps people believe in the project. And if we think someone's all talk or all authority, they're not a leader for long. At least they may be in power for long, but they're not actually leading anymore, because people don't want to follow someone they don't think is the real deal, the authentic example.
So much about this that's, I keep having this word or this term, no-brainer, in my mind as we've been talking about this for the last few weeks. Final one that you talk about under the umbrella of leadership is persuasion. And you say this is the real key to leadership. Take us through how that works.
Well, persuasion is important to every leader, because leadership is actually moving people from A to B. For the sake of the organization or the goals of the organization. So, in a sporting context, it's, to become a better sporting team, to win games. In a military context, it's to win a battle and so on. And so you need to be able to persuade people that the course you want them to take is actually to everyone's benefit, to the goal, for the goals of the organization. So persuasion is actually a really important part of leading people. It isn't the whole. I mean, because if you have too much persuasion, but not enough example, people will believe you for a little while and then get disillusioned because you don't live the talk.
Yeah.
Equally, if you have a great example but no persuasion, you'll be the most loved person in the organization, but no one will be inspired to follow you where you go. So a leader has to be able to say, here's where we could go as an organization. Wouldn't you want to go there? And here are three or four things we could do in the next couple of years to get there. Don't you think that's great? The persuader is often a good leader.
Yeah. The Greeks were good at persuasion?
Yeah, well, they wrote whole books on it, yes. Which is really interesting because it's not an art we are very conscious of anymore. Until the Gruen transfer came along.
Yes, that's good.
That's when we started to think, this is how persuasion works. This is how advertisers get their point across. But actually, the ancient Greeks, Aristotle in particular, were thinking about how persuasion works centuries ago. And Aristotle wrote a textbook 350 years before Jesus on persuasion that was actually a textbook in universities right up until a couple of hundred years ago. And in this book, he basically said that people are persuaded by an intellectual dimension, there has to be a good argument. He called that logos. He said there's also an emotional or psychological dimension that he called pathos. That is, you know, there has to be some sort of art and beauty to the persuasion. It has to sort of resonate with you emotionally. And then he said there's a third dimension, which he actually regarded as the most important dimension in persuasion. He said it's ethos, the character of the persuader. And what he is saying is, doesn't matter how brilliant you are with logos, how much intellect you have, how emotionally riveting or artistic you are as a persuader, if people don't believe in you, they don't think you're a trustworthy person, that your character is real, they won't believe you. And Aristotle had this very simple way of putting it. He said, we tend to believe the good-hearted more than anyone else on all topics. For the simple reason that when we trust a person, that they're of good character and that they wouldn't fib, we end up believing their point of view. But if you think someone is actually in it for themselves, then you rarely trust them because you're always thinking, what's their ulterior motive? Jeez, yeah. Sure, it's a brilliant argument, but I think I'm being taken for a ride here. I don't mean to pick on, you know, used car salesmen, but often the caricature of a used car salesman, every used car salesman I've ever met was a beautiful person for the record, but the caricature of it anyway, is that sure, they may have the beautiful speech and maybe persuasive, but you don't trust them.
No.
And until you trust them, you don't believe them. So I put it this way in the book. The most persuasive person in the world is the one you know has your best interests at heart.
It strikes me that there are powerful lessons in this for anybody in communications, but especially in the business of preaching.
Oh, look, I mean, the day my congregation at St. Andrew's Roseville doesn't trust my character is the day when my sermons will have no effect. Because it doesn't matter how sort of intellectually rigorous it might be, how well I might speak in public. If the people sitting there think, you know what, I don't think this actually has ever seen in this guy's life.
Yeah.
That's when I've just lost all persuasive power. But it's not just a preacher. Leaders of a business, yep. It's the same. If they hear the CEO give a big speech, but actually the employees know that it's all just spin. We're not going to follow. You think of politicians. You know, I mean, the fatal situation we've fallen into with our pollies is we don't trust their character anymore.
Yeah.
And so when we hear them, I mean, just think, you know, late tonight, if you go and turn on the news, listen to a polly, generally our response is, what are they trying to get away with?
Yeah.
What are they trying to spin?
Do I trust them?
What are they covering? That's the death of persuasion. We long for a politician, a leader, that we believe in through and through.
And can trust.
Can trust.
So we've covered so much ground in our conversations about humility. I think we're all probably in agreement that humility is a good thing. It's a beautiful thing, as we've spoken about. But the fact is, lots of people, especially in leadership, are not particularly humble. So in practical terms, we've covered this a bit before. How do I become humble? Or is that an arrogant question?
I think it's an arrogant question. I think it's actually a humble question, because once you spot humility, that it's common sense and it's beautiful and so on, and you go, you know what? I want humility. It's a recognition that you're kind of not humble, right? So it's a humble, yes, it's a humble thing. Yeah. I would say, I mean, there are plenty of ways we could cut at this, but the first thing is to realize the beauty of humility, because we are shaped by what we love. So if you love humility, you're going to find yourself shaped by it. I mean, I often find this just in normal relationship. I never used to be even the least bit funny. Okay. Now, I know I'm not terribly funny now, but...
You're setting yourself up here.
I used to, you know, I was famous for having no sense of humor. And then I met my wife and fell in love with her. And she has enough sense of humor for 17 people. And, you know, I slowly became someone with almost a sense of humor. But see, the thing is, it's because I loved her. Yeah. I was shaped by her.
Yeah.
And some of her qualities rubbed off on me. And I'm just using that as an analogy, really, to say once you love something like humility, it will affect you.
Yeah. On Open House, we're in the final of our series of chats on humility with Dr. John Dixon, the director of the Center for Public Christianity and author of the book Humilitas. John, in the book, you give us some thoughts on how we can cultivate humility, become, for instance, more communal, less selfish. I'd love you to talk us through a couple more of them. We've spoken about how we're shaped by what we love. You also suggest that we reflect on the lives of humble people, which is kind of what you were talking about with Buff in a way. How does this help us become more humble?
Well, you watch how they do it. So I reckon the best example is Jesus. So open Luke's gospel.
Yeah.
And watch this incredibly powerful man treat people better than himself. He's just the perfect example of that. But you could also read the life of Nelson Mandela, Mother Teresa, and plenty of other people. Reflect on their lives, and you'll watch how humility works. And I think that will have an influence on you. Equally, you can read the lives of the truly arrogant, and there are plenty of examples of that, and that will put you off arrogance.
Yes.
Enough. So I think that is one way of doing it. The other is to build into your life some patterns of humility. And so the way I think of this is that cognitive behavioral therapy tells us that not only do new thoughts influence new behaviors can influence new thoughts. Yes. Okay, it works both ways,
yes,
right? So they often think of this in anger management, right? If you could just force yourself in an angry situation, count to 10 or whatever, and think happy thoughts or whatever, you know, force yourself to act in a certain way, over time, that develops new non-angry thoughts. That's cognitive behavioral therapy working. Yes. So what I want to say is, it doesn't sound very spiritual, but I think it's real nonetheless. Just act humble. Yeah. Choose to, because if you think humility is a good thing, just do it. It's a little bit like caring for the poor. You may not want to, but you know it's a great thing, so do it, right?
Yeah.
So just be humble. Write into your diary, you know, praise so-and-so, someone who works for you, you know, Have a conversation with someone that wouldn't normally think that you'd have any time for them at all. Actually act like that, and I think you'll find slowly that the behaviours develop new thoughts.
But then another practical tip you have is to forget about being humble.
Yeah, yeah. Isn't that sort of contradicting myself? What I'm saying is here is, in the end, if you become too focused on being humble, then... You become
proud of being humble.
Yeah, we can become proud of being humble, yeah, but you can also become a little self-absorbed.
Yes,
as if
yes,
the goal of all of this is to have the character of humility. And that's not true. The thinking about humility is simply a stepping stone to actually treating others as better than yourself.
Yeah.
So I would say there comes a point where, having reflected on humility, of trying to build it into your life a little bit, having read the example of other people, you get to the point where you go, yeah, you know, it's just about other people. I'm not thinking about developing a character in myself anymore. I just want to think about how I can help Lee, how I can help, you know, my wife, how I can be other person-centered. And it's when actually you're more absorbed in the other rather than your own character that you will actually be truly humble. But you won't realise it, and that's the beauty.
Yeah, I know. Well, I tell you what, you've helped me enormously through this series. It's been a fabulous series. My final question to you is this. What did writing the book on humility do for you? Are you more humble? How do I ask this? Are you a more humble person? Oh, yes, I am, and I'm proud of it. You must have gained some insights into it.
Oh, well, I've gained a lot of insights. It's kind of embarrassing at one level, but one of the things is it's put public pressure on me to be humble. I'm the guy who wrote the book on it.
Yeah.
So it's kind of terrible. It's in my mind all the time. But look, no, there were a few things that have really helped me, as I read around this sort of topic for the book. And one of them is, being really open to criticism in my workplace. I found that really beneficial. And I think we have pretty good staff ability to call each other on various criticisms. So that's been a lasting thing for me as I've researched this topic. Really be open to other people having better ideas than I have. And the more open I am to that, the more open to their criticism, I've actually found myself flourishing. Because I'm a better man tomorrow when I admit my fault today.
John Dixon, thank you so much for all your insights, and I'll declare it wisdom in exploring this. I'm sure there's been a lot of work and a lot of good thought put into this book, and we've richly benefited from it on Open House. Thanks so much for the last 4 weeks.
Thank you, Lee.
We hope you enjoyed this Open House podcast. Thanks to Christian Super and Real World Technology Solutions. To hear more from Open House, visit openhousecommunity.com.au.